Simon Russell Beale is now regarded by many critics as the preeminent actor of his day. This is obviously a tremendous accolade, and it's well deserved. He's also the hardest working, because at the moment he's performing pretty much simultaneously in 2 3-hour plays at the National Theatre. That is where this interview is taking place, in front of a rather nice photo montage of the actor in Hamlet, looking, well, very pensive in the photo and slightly less pensive in real life, thank goodness. Simon, welcome to Theatre Voice.
Thank you very much.
First of all, you must be going through hell at the moment. As I said, you're appearing in these two plays, and you've got major parts in both, and therefore you must be spending your whole life on the stage, rehearsing, etc. How's it going?
Yes, it's been a hard couple of months. I mean, I hadn't worked out when I accepted both parts that they'd be so neatly dovetailing, so I hadn't worked out that I'd be rehearsing during the day and performing in the evening so much. But now it's on and done and dusted. It's more civilised now. I mean, when I look back on what people used to do at the RSC, and still do at the RSC, of course, is where I grew up as an actor. The workload there was very heavy. I mean, I used to rather love that sort of challenge of saying, what are we doing tonight? And there was one season I did four different plays. So, I mean, there were smaller parts, of course, in those days. But yes, it's heavy, but it's fun, thank God.
And do the parts fit together well? Because Galileo, you've got, if you like, a single part that runs through the play, whereas in The Alchemist, you enter a load of different persona as the kind of the right-hand man to The Alchemist, which reminded me of your role as Moscow with Michael Gambon as well, by the same playwright in Volpone.
Yeah, they couldn't be more different, could they, really? I've tried to find a common link between them, but there isn't one at all, except for perhaps fraud, I don't know. But they're completely different. And yes, it's interesting, that thing about the similarities between Volpone and The Alchemist. I mean, Face, the part of doing The Alchemist, is like Mosca, the part I did in Volpone with Michael Gambon, is the sort of facilitator of the plot, isn't he? He does all the sort of the work of getting people in and to be fooled by this dazzling creature that he's teamed up with, which is, in my case, Alex Jennings is Subtle. So Subtle does all the sort of the big numbers, like Michael Gambon did the big numbers in Volpone, whereas my character tends to run around. Just not just doing the work sounds dreadful, but doing the sort of plot, you know. And also, of course, you don't. The main difference between the two parts of Galileo and Moss and Face is that you never know who Face is. You never really know who Subtle is, actually, the part that Alex is playing, because he's acting the whole time. So, and you know exactly who Galileo is. I mean, I know who that sort of man is, but no idea who Face is.
And you enjoy both of your roles?
Oh, very much. I mean, they're extraordinary, but they're neither of them wholly attractive characters. I mean, Face is very unattractive. And Galileo has lots of things that are attractive about him. He's charismatic. He's obviously a genius, which is, I suppose, attractive in some sense. But he's also, you know, a difficult cuss, and he's... cruel and stupid, and of course eventually he, I suppose by some people's lights, is cowardly, though I have perfect sympathy with that. I mean, being shown instruments of torture, I think I'd kowtow in front of that. But they're interesting in that they're both quite bleak plays in ways that would mean that it could have been rather difficult to play. I mean, Alchemist is a very nasty play, I think. Doesn't have much faith in human nature, does it really? Everyone's a bastard.
And coming up soon, which will increase the workload nicely for you, you're coming back into Spamalot, or coming into the London production of Spamalot in January, I think. You played that in New York last Christmas and into the new year. Is that going to make things even worse for you? Is it going to make it better? Because presumably you need to rehearse that while you're playing the other two?
Oh, no, because, I mean, Galileo ends soon, and The Alchemist goes on till the end of November, and then I have a month off, so I'll have a proper holiday. So I don't regard it as impinging on this workload at all. And of course, I have done it before. So they're saying, well, you know, do you want a week or do you want 2 weeks to get back into it? And I think probably I'll ask if I can do 2 weeks, because I think they might have changed things for the English production to suit an English audience, a British audience. But I'm saying, in other words, in fact, I was going over one of the dance routines just last week to see if I could remember it, and most of it's still there. So it shouldn't take too long to get back on track with that one.
And did you enjoy your experience in New York with Spamalot and the dance routines?
I loved it. I mean, I was pretty. I did it partly because it was something so completely new and different for me to sing and dance in a Broadway musical. I've never done anything like that, and especially the dancing, which, as you probably know, I'm absolutely terrible at. The singing, I sort of had done a bit before of singing. So I felt a little bit more secure, though even that is a different type of singing. I had never sung in a big Western. So anyway, I decided to challenge myself and see what would happen, and I remember reading the script and thinking, oh my god, he's got a tap, it says tap break for King Arthur, and thinking, how the hell am I going to do that, phoning them up in panic and saying I can't tap, and they said, don't worry, you fake it with a pair of coconuts. So thank god. But I do have to do one sort of company number when I have to dance. And I loved it. I mean, the team, the American team over in New York, was so extraordinary. I mean, they, you know, I had a couple of people looking after the dance, were called dance captains, who look after the dancers during the run of a show. And I mean, I think the two of the nicest people you could ever wish to meet, is that the right phrase? Anyway, two of the nicest people I've ever met, and two of the most patient, and weren't having it when I was saying I can't dance, and just pushed me through it, and were just completely responsible for that side of it for me, and a wonderful musical director. So I was made to feel very welcome and very very secure by the time I got on stage. In fact, by the time I got on stage, it was almost too long a rehearsal period, in the fact that they gave me a real generous 5 weeks, which is quite a long time, because nothing could change, so it was all set, so nothing had to be discovered, as it were. So 5 weeks, and so by the time I got on stage, I remember the first night feeling nervous but feeling secure, and that was a major achievement on their part. It really was extraordinary.
How did you get into acting? Have you wanted to be an actor since you were a child?
I have acted since I was a child, but never thought I'd be an actor, and it sort of crept up on me, really. You know, I'd done school plays, and I had, as a lot of people, actors do, a very good English teacher who, you know, asked me to do Lear when I was 17, and Desdemona when I was 14, and all that sort of stuff, and then went to university and did a bit of acting there, although I went principally as a musician, so as a singer, so I had a lot of duties as a singer, and it just sort of crept up on me, you know. My parents are very relieved when I finally decided that's what I was going to do, which is interesting, because they obviously thought, well, obviously he's going to be an actor, you know. But I toyed with singing, and I toyed with academia, and I toyed with, you know, merchant banking. But it was fairly obvious, I think.
And from university, do you manage to get work immediately, and you've kept going ever since?
I've been very, very lucky. I had a little bit of a couple of months of trying to find work, but then a friend of a friend, well, no, it was a friend actually, took over the Travis Theatre in Edinburgh, and she invited me up to appear in a series of short plays there, and from then onwards it's been fairly steady. I mean, I think I have quite a sort of blank face, and I think I've been lucky in that people have been able to or seen to fit me into lots of different types of things. So, I'm a character actor, I suppose. So, I think it's probably easier for character actors than it is for beautiful leading men and women. I think that must be very difficult for them. But I've been lucky. I don't think I've been out of work since then.
And you joined the RSC, and that must have been a great formative time.
Yes, I joined the RSC in the mid-80s. I'd just done a play at the Royal Court, and they saw me there and invited me for the first season, which I was very, felt it was quite a frightening idea, you know, going up for committing myself for 2 years, and I'd never done anything for 2 years, and but I jumped and stayed there for 8. So I had the most wonderful time up in Stratford and in London when we had the Barbican, of course. It's a very formative and very, very important part of my life. And I haven't been back since I left, but I have a sort of emotional attachment to both the company and to the, funny enough, to the town as well, you know, to Stratford and Warwickshire. And they were very good because I started off as a comic actor, and Terry Hands picked me out to do a Chekhov play, The Seagull, and that changed the whole course of my acting as well. So I'm very grateful to them.
What were the other highlights? Shakespeare?
Well, meeting Sam Mendes. I mean, Sam and I have now done something like 7 shows, I think. And our first show was for the RSC Troilus and Cressida. And I wasn't to know that it was going to be such an extraordinarily important part of my life, working with him. But we got on, and then he offered me Richard III, and we did The Tempest there as well. So 3 plays for the RSC, and then, you know, we came to the National to do Othello. So, but he's been a huge figure in my life.
Well, you had the tremendous successes of Uncle Vanya and Twelfth Night, which both worked at the Donmar, where it was so sold out, it was ridiculous, and then took you to New York.
Yes, I mean, what can you say about Uncle Vanya? One of the greatest roles in one of the greatest plays ever written, and what a privilege to have to do that. I found Malvolio much more difficult, actually, in Twelfth Night. I found Malvolio quite a puzzle. But Uncle Vanya, bless him, you know, fantastic opportunity, really. I'd love to do all 4 of the big Chekhovs, but I think I probably missed my chance on Andre in The Three Sisters, which is a shame, but there you go.
And then, more recently, you've spent a lot of time at the National, and also other performances at the Donmar, but do you want to talk a little bit about the National?
Well, the National, as you now know, it's now my sort of professional, my second home, isn't it? And and when Nick took over, he made me an associate, and along with Alex Jennings, which meant that there was a sort of, I don't know, it was like a blessing from above, you know. And I suppose, although I'd love to go back to the RSC, I regard this place now as home, and it's the most amazing creative building. I mean, quite apart from that, we're sitting here talking, and we can look over at the river and St. Paul's, and quite apart from the situation, which is so amazing, I happen to be one of those people who love the building, actually love the architecture of the building, and just the sheer rate and passion of work here. I mean, we just opened The Alchemist, and suddenly they're opening The Seafarer, which is the next play in, and I said, oh my God, you know, I didn't even realise it was sort of rehearsing. It's just sort of like there was a group of people in this building who were doing something intense and intensely difficult and important and wonderful, and I was unaware of it, and now it's coming into full bloom. And also, of course, they're going through now what we went through a week ago. So I love that feeling that they're always, it's always at any moment there's always somebody at the same at one particular point of the cycle, you know.
What about your Hamlet? Because that you came to it relatively late, I suppose, but was that a it must have been an amazing experience playing the part, and the plaudits you got must have been part of the making of your career.
Yes, I was 40, which is really the upper limit, I would guess. In fact, Alex was talking, I think he did it when he was about 40. We were both latecomers to it. Which, in retrospect, of course, I'm extremely grateful for, because perhaps I was a little bit more in control of what I could do. And the response to it was unexpected and fantastic, because it was a very gentle Hamlet, and he was, and I've said this before, but he was a person, he's not the person I thought he would turn out. I went into the rehearsal room with not very many ideas, but the few ideas were about a slightly harsher edged Hamlet, and he just turned out to be a sweet prince, and that was quite risky, I think, in a way, because it wasn't saying, you know, this is extraordinarily dazzling or anything. It's just a poor little lost guy, and I was encouraged by the director to do that, and so the fact that it was well received was amazing. Of course, it changed things in the way people saw me, but it most importantly changed. I mean, anybody who plays Hamlet, I don't know what it is, I can't put my finger on why, but it's just one of those parts that, as you know, is changes a person's life. I mean, there was a past Hamlet, and I think it was Paul Rees, who came and saw it. And in the bar afterwards, having a beer afterwards, and he muttered to me, "It's good, isn't it?" I said, "Yeah, it's good."
And how did that experience compare with playing Macbeth at the Almeida?
Macbeth was less well received, of course, and so in that sense that was a bit sad. But I'd probably like another attempt at that one day if I could. But that's an amazing play. And again, I wanted to sort of, I was fascinated by the fact that murder, for some bizarre reason, gives him this extraordinary voice that he's almost, he says to other people, he says almost nothing before he murders the king. You know, difficult, taciturn man, doesn't give anything away, not even to his wife. We don't really see him giving much away to his wife, and then suddenly something's released, and she does say to him after the murder, and he starts speaking in a particular way, and she says, "I've never heard you speak like this." And what he produces is poetry of great beauty. Now that's the worry. And I just found that fascinating. Of why, what that psychology is about. But it meant that it became very, very internalized and very shut in, and not a sort of personal journey. And there wasn't much blood and guts. And also, I was very keen that at the end of the play, he should be sort of stationary, you know, which is because of something in the text about, you know, he says, let them come to me. If they want to get rid of me, you come to my castle and get rid of me that way. I'm not going to go out and fight you. And it's a bit of a mixed picture in the text. It's not sure whether he is doing that or whether he's in fact going out. But I like the idea of him sitting like a great big boulder, refusing to move.
You're beginning to sound from this like purely a classical actor, and you're a great classical actor, but you've throughout your career varied your roles immensely, so almost alternating a lot of the time between classical roles, and you're in Jumpers, you're in The Philanthropist. Do you enjoy doing the modern work? Do you like mixing it up?
Oh, I love it. Yes, and I always get rather depressed when people assume that I only do Shakespeare. Not that he isn't, you know, one of the best in the world, but no, I mean, things like, I mean, The Philanthropist is, I mean, I love it when you do a play and you read it and you think, this is lovely, I'd love to do this play, but when you work on it, you think, this is actually a great play, and that's what happened with The Philanthropist. I thought, gosh, this is an extraordinary thing to do, to write a character like this at the centre of a play. And for a young man of 20-something, I think it was 20s, his 20s, Christopher, to write so well about middle age. It was an extraordinary achievement, really. But I love this idea of the sheer chutzpah of saying, I'm going to go and write a play about a man who doesn't like conflict, you know, and likes everybody. See if it works. And, you know, There are probably things people don't like about it, but I think it substantially works, and I think it's actually a very moving play about lost opportunities and also funny, of course, but lost opportunities and sort of regret's the wrong word, because he hasn't done anything to regret. It's just a sort of like a blank space. I think that's a very clever piece of writing. So it's lovely when you do a new play and you think, or a modern play, and it's even better than you imagined it to be.
You've managed to become a star of the West End and a darling on Broadway. You've not done all that much in the way of broadcast work, I don't think. I will never forget your Widmer Pool, which you may regret, because it's a strange part to play in Anthony Powell's Dance, The Music of Time.
I loved Widmer Pool, Kenneth. I loved him, and I love the process. It's just that certainly telework hasn't really come my way. And I think now people probably are saying, oh, well, Simon does theatre. And there is no question that theatre is my great passion. And also sort of what I'm trained to do now. But if some TV work came up that was wonderful, of course I'd do it. And as I say, Wibblepool was a fascinating character to do. And the same with film. And but it just hasn't come up, really. I think it's probably a sort of self-fulfilling prophecy, but it hasn't come up.
You seem to have the next 6 months probably fairly well organised with these two plays, and then early in the new year with Spamalot returning to King Arthur. Have you got any plans further ahead than that? Have people got plans for you?
No, not at the moment. I'm going to take you out to June, and then I'm going to have a bit of a break, a bit of a holiday, and then I don't know, really. I don't know. I mean, there's always Shakespeare, and there are a couple of parts I really would like to try.
Which are those?
Well, I'm a bit scared of them at the moment. I'd love to do a Benedick, but I'm really scared of Benedick. And I want to do Falstaff, but again, I'm scared of him. But I think I'm just 5 years too young for that. But Shakespeare, so they're those sort of two, really. And you know, obviously, like any actor in the theatre, you know, if somebody wrote a new play and said they'd like to be a part of it, of course, they'd jump at the chance. I don't really know. I don't plan my. I've never planned my career like that. I mean, occasionally you say, "Oh God, I'd really love to do Galileo," and then somebody picks up on the idea, but that's about as far as it gets, which is sort of what happened with this. But very rarely do I say, "I've got a play and I'd really like to be in it," because I don't think I'm a very good caster of myself, and also I'm not that knowledgeable. But I hope something comes up next year. I mean,
there's certainly a challenge to playwrights out there. Simon Russell Beale would like to do a new play. Write one for him.
Wouldn't that be lovely if I could do that? Write a play for me, please. Yeah.
Okay, Simon Russell Beale, I know that you're exceptionally busy at the moment. Thank you very much indeed.
Pleasure. Thank you.